Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Robin Winkler. Robin was a commercial lawyer until 2001 when, after having read some books, been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, and taking time to reflect, flipped to the social and environmental justice side, gave up United States citizenship, and founded Wild at Heart Legal Defense Association Taiwan. Since that time, he's been mostly involved in trying to understand how to stop the decimation of different strains of humans, other species and beings, and transcendence. His favorite authors include Paul Shepard, Rachel Carson, me, that's very kind of you, Peter Kropotkin, and Vandana Shiva. And so first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
It's a real pleasure to be here. And I don't know if my work in the world is doing anything other than instructing developers on how to be even more evil and clever, but anyway, yeah, no, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
You know, that's something that we all run into, and I've discussed this many times with Thomas Lindsay, that in his work to attempt to stop like big box stores or huge factory hog farms from going into an area, or fracking from going into an area, that by trying to stop them through the regulatory system, all that does oftentimes is make them write slicker documents. So this is a common problem that all of us face.
Well, I'm glad to hear I have company, because I often have the feeling here that when I say this, people just kind of look at me. I mean, you know, people who we work together and they're sympathetic and doing good work and stuff, but they look at me and they say, well, what are you saying then? And it really came home to me. I was in from 2005 to 2007, a really fluke, but I got appointed to this, the Environmental Impact Assessment Committee, central government of Taiwan under the, we have an EPA, Environmental Protection Administration. And this committee is extremely powerful. It's 21 members, and 14 of which have to come from non-government offices. And this was the first time that the sort of the committee, the appointment committee, there were some really a very insistent person who's been doing study on Taiwan trees for the last 40 years and is really among, I mean, he's our, I don't know who I would compare him to. Maybe he doesn't care for Aldo Leopold for some reason. Anyway, he's the father of our environmental movement here. And he was on the appointment committee, and he stayed there for a day and a half and made sure I got on, along with about 10 other pretty committed environmentalists. But my term ended after 2 years. It was a great 2 years. We got made a lot of progress in opening up the process so that people could participate, so that the documents would be online and people could know what was going on, and we delayed a few projects. I mean, some have still not happened, but that was what, 14 years ago? And today, everything that we did, you can kind of look and see how the EPA, now that committee, operates, and the government operates, and the developers operate, and they really studied what we had done, and they basically have a playbook now that it's really hard to do what we were doing at that time. So yeah, so that's a real kind of dilemma. But yeah.
Well, and one more thing about that is that's really the I don't want to say natural history, but it is sort of the, I don't want to say evolution either, because both of those are kind of sacred terms, but that's really how regulatory agencies are routinely captured. You know, this happens everywhere with all of these, that they can start off perhaps with good intentions, perhaps not, but in any case, another way to say this is Every time environmentalists figure out how to use the rules to stop the destruction, those in power change the rules.
Yeah, that's a pretty fair. Or in our case, I mean, we actually got a court decision canceling a project. This would have been, well, it was while I was on the panel. So we started the case in 2005, and it was the development of a big, what they, you know, they don't call them industrial parks anymore. They call them science parks. And so this was a big science park in central Taiwan, and lots of farmland, it's just a mess. We brought a lawsuit under the environmental impact assessment law, and we won, which meant that they canceled. The court said that the environmental impact assessment approval was invalid. Okay, so we won that, but then the next day the government took out half-page ads in all the major newspapers and said the courts are stupid. They don't know what they're doing. I was kind of shocked because I don't know how much people know about Taiwan, but it's basically was under martial law from 1949 to 1977. So that was the longest, other than the Philippines, I think, that for martial law, and then the White Terror and all this. I mean, it was a really totalitarian dictatorship and pretty nightmare for anyone that spoke out against anything that the government was doing. Since that time, since the end of martial law and then direct election of president and all this, it's a democracy, and we've got some, you know, we've got some pretty interesting things. The only place in Asia, I think, where gay marriage is legal, and that's pretty recent, but it's a very vibrant democracy, I guess. And I grew up in the States until I was 21. So I was, I still have this idea, and I don't know. I'm kind of curious where you come down on this, but I still think of, you know, separation of powers, and that, yes, there's a balance in judicial and legislature and executive. There is a role for that. And the legislature comes in, and then the executive carries it out. And if they screw up, or go against the spirit of the law, then that's where the courts come in. And so this was when the government came out and said the decision to cancel this or to revoke the permit by the courts was stupid and illegal. And by the way, they didn't change the rules. They reinterpreted the rules, and they just went ahead and did what they wanted to do. So yeah, that was a long response to your thing, but yeah, change the rules or just ignore the rules or okay. Well, are we going to get on a more positive note here or something?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be positive or not, but but I want to know more about how the environmental system works in Taiwan for another interview, but. You and I had agreed that, I mean, this is all sort of a long introduction here, but you and I had agreed that what we were going to talk about was the white dolphin, the pink dolphin, the humpback dolphin, whatever name we want to call it. And I would love it if you could do an introduction to, and we're specifically in Taiwan is what we were talking about, but I was wondering if you could do an introduction to this. Creature who is either a species or a subspecies, depending on whom you talk to. And we can talk about the political implications of that and the environmental implications of that too, if you want.
Sure. Yeah. Now just feel free to jump in and cut me off. I've just gone and grabbed a couple of books in case we were having our offline chat and you said the evolutionary history and all that stuff. I'm probably not going to be able to answer, but, let me see. I've got a little, got a little brochure here that we issue, and probably I'll just kind of follow that. Your readers no doubt are aware that dolphins, porpoises, and whales are cetaceans, so I may call them cetaceans. In the waters around Taiwan, there have been records in the world. I think there are like about 93 or 95 species of cetaceans, dolphins, porpoises, and whales. But around the waters of Taiwan, there are records of over 33 or 35. So it's pretty interesting. Most people think of dolphins and whales in Taiwan. They think about the East Coast, which is relatively undeveloped. People, again, I go back to, we were in martial law until 1987, which means people of my generation, and I'm 67 now, but people 40 years and older, and that's kind of most of the people that are running the country and the big corporations and all that stuff. Most of them grew up where you couldn't go to the ocean. You couldn't go to the seashore. I mean, Taiwan's an island, but because of military concerns and Taiwan's, I'm not sure if we still are at war with China or not. I don't know how that works, but China, you know, wants to take over Taiwan. There have been reports recently in the newspaper about how the airspace is being invaded and all that stuff. So what that came down to, there was a really good part of that aspect of that. There was almost no development of the coast, west, east, anything. And so, and actually of a lot of the mountainous areas in Taiwan. So that martial law, I mean, if I say this to Taiwanese, they really get, I am Taiwanese too, but to fellow Taiwanese, they get a little upset because I suggest that maybe martial law was not such a bad thing, for those beings other than humans. But the thing is that basically.
Oh, wait. I mean, yeah. Let's just be honest here. I mean, yes, war is horrible, and I'm not saying anything good about war, but the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is a refuge for non-humans. I mean, basically what this says is that this culture is at such horrible war with the natural world that when that war is disrupted by any sort of thing, including a crazy demilitarized zone or martial law, I mean, that's not saying that we want martial law. What it's saying is, look how destructive this culture is, because if that destruction is interrupted by any means, then nature happens to do better there. That's all it's saying, really.
Absolutely. No, I fully concur. There's a, if you don't mind, I'll just go on with that for a little bit.
Please.
In Taiwan, Taiwan was a very, very, very brief history, but I think it's important for background. Basically, there have been discoveries of people in Taiwan back to 40,000 years ago. There are some caves and so forth where they've got some jade implements and all kinds of stuff. So, but the current people of Taiwan now, they trace back to about 7,000 years ago. And then the Chinese started kind of coming in the about 600 or 700 years ago occasionally, and then the Portuguese came in about the 1600s, and the Spanish, and all the colonizers and so forth. But it remained pretty wild and untouched by civilization until the late 1800s. And then the Japanese came in, and there was an incident, and so they had a punitive expedition, and then Japan and China had a war, and then China said, well, we'll give you Formosa. So that's what Taiwan is also known as. Yeah, the Portuguese, that comes from Portuguese, Ilha Formosa, the beautiful island. So that was, the Portuguese were here maybe about 300 or 400 years ago. But the Japanese then in 1895 came in, and Taiwan was a colony of Japan, but actually, you know, we're part of the Okinawan island chain. So actually, it kind of made sense. I mean, you know, from that imperialist idea, but unlike the other Japanese colonies in Southeast Asia, the Philippines and so forth, Taiwan was going to be integrated into Japan. But then in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, Taiwan was given military protectorate status. So technically, and that never ended, technically we're still under the military protectorship of the United States. I mean, that's pretty much a fact. But having been sort of lots of Chinese and Han Chinese people here, and there were relations and so forth, so China now claims that Taiwan is a part of China and inalienable part. Now, why am I going? Oh God, now I'm really getting off. Okay, what I wanted to do. Okay, so the Chinese came in after 1945, and then people probably know that there was a big civil war going on in China since the 20s between the communists and the nationalists. So that war escalates. The communists, Mao Zedong and his people, win, and the nationalists, they come to Taiwan, the U.S. military protectorate. Well, that U.S. military protectorate wasn't really advertised or emphasized. And I guess the U.S. probably saw, well, these Chinese nationalists, because they're anti-communists, they have some use to us. So they let them come to Taiwan. And then during the Korean War, they really needed Taiwan. And then the Vietnam War. So Taiwan became, you know, kind of an important military strategic place. And China still claims it today. But these nationalists came here in 1949. And soon after, 45. And then after about 4 years, people got kind of fed up. And they said, well, these, you know, at least the Japanese were kind of interesting and clever, but these people are just totally backwards. It was mostly soldiers and that sort of, I'm not demeaning soldiers, but it was because at that time, soldiers in Taiwan had been basically kidnapped from the rural areas and they didn't want to be there. So they, now they come to Taiwan and they see this really pretty wealthy place. I mean, in the 30s and 40s, Taiwan was ahead of Singapore, was ahead of Hong Kong. It was the, after Japan, it was the second sort of wealthiest, prosperous place in Asia by, you know, mainstream standards, living material stuff and that stuff. So anyway, so there's all this unrest in Taiwan, resentment and sort of outbreaks of revolution. And then the 228 incident, I think it's 1948 or 49. But the 228. The reason I mention that is when I first started doing Wild at Heart about 18 years ago, this man that I think I mentioned, the dendrologist who studied trees for 40 years and got me into the Environmental Impact Assessment Committee, he, in his lectures, would use the phrase, I'm trying to think how to translate, nature's 228, the massacre of nature. And boy, did that get people really resented that because they had, you know, they had family members that had been killed. I mean, there's estimates of 10, 20, 30,000 people massacred. And then the white terror continued and really until the 90s.
I would like to change the focus of our interview away from the pink dolphin and to continue this history of Taiwan and start to weave in more of the environmental stuff, because I would love to. I think what you're saying is really fascinating and important. And as we said, as we were talking about before we started the recorder, I don't think a lot of people know much of this history. I mean, I am kind of a history nerd myself, and especially a military nerd. You know, I know all about World War One, World War Two, American Civil War. I know all those things cold, and I don't know much of the history of Taiwan. So I, at least, am finding this incredibly fascinating, and I'm wondering if we can continue with it. Just keep, all I'm saying is keep doing what you're doing, and let's if you want to talk about the dolphins a little bit, that's fine, but I want to devote a full 45 minutes to them another time.
Great. Well, I did want to. This is all leading up to how. Oh,
I know it's going to be. Except, I think you can also. I mean, as I said beforehand, I've heard that there are predator cats in Taiwan, which blows me away. Because when I think about Taiwan, honestly, and this is just going to show my own ignorance, I basically think about skyscrapers and people living all on top of each other. I don't think about forests, and I don't think I'm alone in my, and I am acknowledging my complete ignorance. So I think that everything you're saying is going to be news to a lot of people, and I want you to keep going. That's all I'm saying, and I should have said that and shut up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to,
I don't know what 228 is. I don't know what the White Terror is. And again, for crying out loud, I know the difference between, you know, the Panzer IV and the Panzer IIId and the Panzer IIIe and the Junker 87B, to use a bunch of German military stuff from World War II. I know all that crap, but I have no idea of this. And again, I don't think that I am more ignorant than most people. So this is really, I think, important stuff for people to know. Because that's another thing that just, sorry to go on about this so long, but this just kills me that, in the United States, at least, we hear every time the president sneezes or the opposition burps, we hear about that. But, oh, I'll give you an example that's real, is there was a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan earlier this year, and I heard about it not on the news, but on a internet site where they make fun of everybody. And it was interesting. I just have to say two more sentences about that, which is it's the internet site was it was basically people would provide information, and then a bunch of Turks came in, and of course Turks hate Armenians, so they're saying terrible things about the Armenians. But in order to do that, they had to actually present the news articles in the first place from around the world. My point is, we in the United States don't know jack about anywhere. And I'm including myself, because I've never heard of 228, where evidently tens of thousands of people were killed. So, So please give more of that background, because I don't think I'm the only ignorant one here.
Okay, well, I'll make a plug. My wife is a publisher, and so the 228 incident, that was at the end of the 40s. The Chinese came into Taiwan. There's a lot of resentment, and Taiwan population at the time was maybe 4 million, or 24 million today, but at that time about 4 million, and between 1.5 and 2 million Chinese came into Taiwan and kind of took over, and they took all the infrastructure that the Japanese had built and controlled all the property and the corporations.
Wait,
and,
I'm sorry, what were the native Taiwanese, what are they called? You said that the Chinese came in. What are the native Taiwanese?
Okay. This is getting very political now. But it is a fact that people, the Taiwanese, the native Taiwanese, have been here for, as I said, 7,000 years. There's a, I think your readers will all probably know Jared Diamond, I think he's an ornithologist, actually, but he's written all those books like Collapse and whatever. But anyway, so he came out with an article that was published in Nature along with some Australian linguists who had done studies. And it's a wonderful art, very short, Taiwan's Gift to the World. And it's basically about how all the languages from Madagascar to Easter Island, so that includes the Indian Ocean, up Hawaii, New Zealand. It doesn't include Australia and parts of Indonesia, but all those other places, all those other islands and stuff, and it, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of different languages. They all are traced back to the 13, I think it's 13 or maybe it's 9. Anyway, ethnolinguists or whatever, they have traced all those languages back to Taiwan. And so this is all the origins of the South Pacific peoples, again, the New Zealand and Indian Ocean, all the way to Madagascar, Hawaiian, all those languages have roots in the native languages of Taiwan. So those are the people that were here when the Portuguese first discovered it, and discovered it in 1600 and said Ilha Formosa, beautiful island. They'd been here and managing this place for those thousands of years. So then I mentioned the Japanese came in 1895, 50 years, and then the Chinese came in. Now, there had been a lot of migration to Taiwan from China over the years. And that what had happened is that they had pushed the people, the native inhabitants, they pushed them further and further inland. So and that was the first big industry in Taiwan was deer pelts. Almost all those deer are gone. There were two species, and they've been reintroduced and rehabilitated and so forth. But those deer, and then you mentioned the cats, the big cats with the leopard, the cloud leopard, which now is extinct. That's a big one. I mean, that's like a panther size. It's, more than a meter long at full development. But that cloud leopard is no longer in Taiwan. They've now confirmed its extinction about 10 years ago. But those were the predators on these deer. When the deer were gone, of course, and the predators go further into the hills, but also they brought agriculture to Taiwan, and that they needed land. And so they pushed the people further and further into the mountains. So that was all going on for those thousands of years, and then the era of colonization and all that stuff, the same story around the world. But the people of Taiwan now, they were doing DNA and all that stuff testing and studies in the late 90s and early 2000s, and they determined that probably a little over 80% of the people in Taiwan, they have DNA that's indigenous. So they're not. They've been mixing with the Han or the Chinese people, but China is not a monolithic place either. A lot of them were indigenous people from the Yue tribe along the coastal part of China that were migrating into Taiwan. And the Chinese government during that time, during the 18 and 1900s, prohibited women from coming to Taiwan. So obviously there was all this intermarriage. So the people of Taiwan are very extremely varied, diverse. And you have very, very dark people, as black as anyone in Africa, in the very south eastern part. It's a small community, but they are a distinct ethnic group, distinct language, and so forth. So, but the dominant culture since 1945 has been the Chinese. and or the Han that we probably better term for it. And then of course China claims that Taiwan is a part of China, and then the nationalist government that is still here, although we have a democratically elected and it's the other party now, it's not the Nationalist Party, but it is still the Republic of China. I mean that is still the dominant culture, people, food, everything else. But over the last 25, 30 years, there's been a resurgence, and there are 16 recognized indigenous minorities here. But they constitute maybe 2.5% of the entire population. So 24 million, that's what, 500,000 or something. I can't do the math on that, but 500,000 or 600,000. But again, 70% to 80% of all the people here have indigenous blood or DNA. And so that's always an interesting topic, is who's really indigenous and what counts and so forth. And but there you have it. So that's Taiwan. And I'm probably gonna run out before I even get to the dolphins, but what I was gonna say was that you had martial law, no opening, no activity along the seacoast, all these, 35 species of dolphins and porpoises and whales, and they're doing pretty well until the Chinese decide that they're really probably never going to go back and take back China, because that was the myth. That's why they kept martial law and so forth, because they were going to go back and kick the communists out and take back China for the, free China. That wasn't happening. And by the mid 80s, it was pretty clear that they weren't going back, that they better stay in Taiwan. And so actually this was the '70s. When I first arrived here in 1977, they had just launched the 10 great construction projects. And that was really the beginning of the end. And that's what my mentor, Professor Chun, refers to as the natural 228 in Taiwan, the beginning and the white terror that was not, so it's kind of sensitive because you have all these families who had members that were killed and tortured and spied on and all that stuff for decades. And then comes this tree lover, nature lover, but I mean, he's really a prolific author and has done studies and is highly respected. But he comes out and says, nature's 228 in Taiwan started with these 10 major construction projects, and it really hasn't subsided. So I don't know. I hope I'm making sense.
No, you are. You are. This is really fascinating. So can we go? Let's leave off the white dolphins till next time.
And, okay.
Let's go back.
Can I just kind of bring the dolphins yes, in general into this?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so you had all this martial law, no development along the coast, and then things start to open up, and they're building this 10 major construction projects. It was the Taiwan's first nuclear plant with two reactors, and now we have six operating. But that's another program. Major huge ports development, one in central Taiwan on the west coast, two in eastern Taiwan, national airport, the Taiwan's first superhighway. So these are the 10 major construction projects. Oh, a huge petrochemical refinery and that stuff. So these projects go on, and a lot of them involve the coast. So you start, people are going back to the coast now. The fishers have always been there, the fishers, but they're being displaced. But people are starting to look at the natural environment and what's going on here. Taiwan, we get a we got our first national park, I think, in 19, right around the time that martial law ended. So that's the mid 80s. So there's, you know, there's sort of a, as people are getting a little more wealthy and the government is opening up a little bit, people are starting, it's becoming more popular to look at nature and talk about these things. And then, of course, the environmental movement in the West is, they're leaking into Taiwan, at least some knowledge of it, because people have gone abroad and studied and picked up on that. But now the government is saying, we're not going back to China. We need to develop Taiwan. And that means infrastructure. And it just, this is Taiwan's 228 against nature. It's not a slaughter of lots of people, but boy, the speed and the ferocity and the efficiency, that all happened here, was pretty devastating. So people are not, I mean, the government, the whole thing now is we got to develop. And, that included, of course, the coastline, the ocean. But in the meantime, there was a lot more visits to Taiwan, and this group, these environmental groups in the U.S. found out that, I don't know if you saw The Cove, that movie about the dolphin slaughter in Japan, the dolphin runs. And there were these dolphin runs. I think the Faroe Islands has them. Japan still has them. It's, you know, where they, every year at a certain season, the dolphins are migrating or passing by, and they herd them into a cove, and this massive slaughter happens. Well, this was popularized or became fairly well known. I expect some of your listeners have heard about it, but it's called, the movie's called The Cove, and it's by the guy who I think was Flipper's trainer or something. If anyone is old enough to remember Flipper, but this is a guy that really then just had an awakening and said, what are we doing here? But anyway, so Japan has this dolphin run, Faroe Islands have the dolphin run, and Taiwan, the Pescadore Islands, which is right in the middle of the Taiwan Straits, but it's controlled by Taiwan. It's one of our counties, Penghu or Pescadores. And that dolphin run was discovered by some Americans, and they said, how can we do this? And Taiwan, not being a member of the United Nations, we were kicked out of the United Nations in 1970, or we walked out because the communists were let in and we didn't want to be a part of that. So that was really stupid. But it means Taiwan's been totally isolated from a lot of the internet, good and bad stuff over the last 50, 60 years. But these people then discovered, so Taiwan can't be sanctioned like under, what's the, the New York Convention, or there's some UN treaties on protection of wildlife and so on. Taiwan's out of that, so we can't be sanctioned. But the U.S. Congress passed this thing they called the Pelley Amendment. And it was specifically to take action against Taiwan because of its treatment of different wildlife. We were importing animals from all around the world. They used to eat monkey brains, live monkey. I mean, when I first got here, this is just disgusting, but maybe another time I'll describe the horrendous, practices, but there are all these things. There was a place called Snake Alley where they had snakes that were cut alive, and it was next to the area where the legal prostitutes were, and it was supposed to enhance virility and so forth. So that's another story. But the treatment of wildlife here, I mean, we've got tigers and all kinds of things were being imported and displayed and so forth. And these groups are becoming aware, and they discover, oh my God, there's this dolphin slaughter that happens every year in the Pescadores. And so they took it to the U.S. and the U.S., this is late 80s, early 90s. And the U.S., you know, it's part of the Pelley Amendment that gets sanctions against Taiwan unless they, you know, boost their wildlife protection practices. And Taiwan as dependent. I mean, we're so dependent on the U.S. because the U.S. broke diplomatic, the U.S. only recognized Taiwan as the sole legitimate government of China until, I think it's Carter in 1978. He finally did the deal. I mean, Nixon and Kissinger had started it to kind of, you know, but the U.S. and the Republic of China on Taiwan, you know, that was that Republic of China and Taiwan, that was China to the U.S. and much of the rest of the world until the 70s and 80s. So Taiwan gets kicked out of the U.S. and then U.S. severs relation. And so we've only got diplomatic relations now with maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13, 14 countries maybe. And they're all very, most quite small and politically not that influential. So all the other countries have recognized China, which makes sense, I guess. But so the U.S. has tremendous influence on Taiwan. These people, these environmental groups, were able to go to Congress and get them to tell Taiwan, you can stop this dolphin practice or we're going to take some sanctions. And Taiwan just freaked. And they looked around and they discovered. Now, Taiwan used to be quite a whaling center, but whaling, legal whaling in Taiwan, I think it stopped in early 70s. But it was a major whaling country, you know, killing whales for blubber and whatever other ambergris and that kind of stuff. But that had ended, but there was still these dolphin runs going on in the pescadores. So the U.S. took Taiwan to account for that. Taiwan freaked out, looked around, found they didn't have any they didn't have anyone who knew anything about dolphins or the oceans, because they'd had this martial law going on for 40 years. And guess what? You know, we're an ocean country, but nobody knows anything about the ocean because they weren't allowed to get near it and study it and so forth. So they go out and they find a woman who studied, I think she studied some kind of wasps, a zoologist, and they recruit her and she becomes Taiwan's expert on cetaceans. This is mid-90s and she is, to this day, the primary influence on Taiwan and total, it's a lucrative position for her. That's, I can say, I don't think she's really, I don't know. The interests of Taiwan cetaceans have not been well served by this person. And so to this day, she kind of dominates, you know, everyone who's now in marine biology, doing work on marine mammals was a student of hers. A few have turned and have joined, the right side, which I think is my side, and are truly, doing conservation work rather than just, making a lot of money, doing research and then putting a rubber stamp on development projects saying it will have no significant impact on the cetaceans. So that's kind of the history of dolphin, what happened with the dolphins, in Taiwan. And, you know, there's still lots of those species, but I guess the next program will probably have a chance or at some point. I'd love to share with you stories about in 2002, this pink dolphin species or sub. It's now we now can say with certainty it's a subspecies. Whether that matters, that's a controversy in itself. But anyway, they were discovered in 2002. At that time, they suspected there could be as many as a few hundred, but they did surveys, Canadian, Taiwanese, and Hong Kong team, scientists from those three places, continued to do surveys. And basically they said, okay, well, there's certainly fewer than 100. They, in 2008 managed to get this population, classified as critically endangered by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is the big, It's basically a UN organization, so they refer to us as Taiwan Province of China, which sucks. But anyway, they're critically endangered, and that is sort of the newest species of dolphin that's been discovered. It's the only one that is endemic to Taiwan. It's the only subspecies that's endemic to Taiwan. It's Susa chinensis taiwanensis. So the scientific name is Susa chinensis, which they generally call Chinese white dolphin. But this Susa chinensis, that species is found in Thailand, in Indonesia, along the coast of China and so forth. But all seem to be isolated populations because the genus Susa, which is found in Australia and West Africa and East Africa, I think there's four, maybe five species under that genus. The humpback dolphins, they all stay in waters less than 20, 30 meters at maximum, more likely, because they depend on generally estuary waters and where you've got the nice mix of fresh and fresh water coming in and bringing all the nutrients, which seems to contribute to their food. So although those members of that genus are shallow water inhabitants, and the Taiwanese white dolphin, which was discovered in 2002 by scientists, fishers knew about it. And there was some speculation before that, but this subspecies was just discovered in 2002. And now we've got maybe 60 to 65 left. And they are going into, confrontation now with Taiwan's major push for green energy, the subject of your book, offshore wind farms. So where you've got this thousands of offshore wind turbines are going to go into the waters where this critically endangered species lives. And so among the 30 or so species that Taiwan claims to be in its waters, species of cetaceans, this one is the only one that's resident year-round. It's the only one that is endemic, and we're not doing a very good job of giving them a welcome. I don't know. We're destroying their habitat for a number of reasons, and there's a lot of threats, and that's probably a whole nother program.
We're running out of time, and I would love to have you again this has been, for me at least, such an incredibly fascinating introduction to Taiwan, and I would love to do another one about these dolphins. I would love to do one about the wildlife in general in Taiwan. But can you end today by talking for a couple, 3 minutes about the Wild at Heart Legal Defense Association? Just introduce that briefly, and then that's where we'll take it today.
Okay, well, thank you. Sure. Love talking about Wild at Heart. I was a commercial lawyer, so for 20-some years. I started law offices, worked at law offices and stuff in Taiwan, but I had my own firm, and it broke up, and I started a new firm. And the reason it broke up was I was getting ideas about social enterprise, and my colleagues were just basically, they were typical lawyers that wanted to make as much money as possible. And I was turning away clients because I didn't like what they were doing and so forth. Then I got real sick, and then I got sick to the point that they said I was going to die. And I realized, well, maybe it has something to do with what I'm doing, and so maybe I shouldn't do what I'm doing. And I was surfing at the county library where I was recovering, and I came across the Natural Resource Defense Council and Earth Justice. Now, I had read about a Supreme Court ruling with Justice Douglas dissenting, which basically should trees have standing, the legal rights of nature. So I'd had some exposure to that, but then, you know, I'm sick and I don't know if I'm ever going to live and all this stuff. And I see this NRDC, Earth Justice. Yeah, that's what I want to do. And so I got better and I gave up U.S. citizenship so I wouldn't be kicked out of the country. And I started this wild defense legal, wild at heart legal defense association. That was 2002 or 2003. And basically it's some lawyers in Taiwan. We've just got three lawyers. I mean, it's not a huge organization, but we are one of three now. There are two other such groups, but they kind of bringing law into conservation and social justice. So we're working on, we're working on, they want to build a new airport runway. We've got litigation on that. They want to develop a sort of the last portion of Taipei City that is reasonably undeveloped by conventional terms. We're litigating that. A lot of environmental impact assessment related stuff, because our environmental impact assessment law gives us, in fact, seven or eight of our laws give organizations like us legal standing to bring lawsuits. So you don't have to be, you know, directly affected by this development or in its backyard or in its front yard to bring lawsuits. You can do it as a concerned organization. So that's what that's kind of what we do. And we do some policy work. And it's, we're really influenced by, I am anyway, by the work that you've done, and people like Arnie Nass and I guess the deep ecologists, one might call it, which is hard to do because people still have this development mentality. But that's basically wild at heart. Another major big project that we're doing is this 7,000-year-old algal reef where they want to put in they are putting in an LNG receiving facility, and it's going to it's not a coral reef, but it's just as interesting and alive and so forth. It's not quite as pretty, one might say, but if you look closely, algal reef, ALGAL, I think, there's some things you can Google on that, for the readers that might not have come across that. But yeah, so we're doing that. We get involved in some social, like fishers and a lot of work on indigenous. We've got litigation now on they're putting in a big industrial waste incinerator, which we're trying to stop on behalf of one of the indigenous communities in eastern Taiwan. So that's what we do. I think we got seven or eight people full time and then two or three and some volunteers. And I sure need English and Chinese speaking and reading volunteers if anyone's out there and we can help remotely. We frequently can use precedent from other countries in the Taiwan court. So it's always helpful to do that. And I work with a couple of groups in the U.S. Particularly people involved in dolphin conservation and research. So in the U.S. and Canada and Europe. So that's wild in a nutshell.
Okay. So one last thing. If people want to know about the Wild at Heart Legal Defense Association, what's your website? And then we should come back another time.
Okay, I'm pretty sure it's just wildatheart.org.tw.
Okay, wildatheart.org.tw.
Yeah. I mean, if you Google it, I think it comes up fairly readily. I mean, environment. And there's a great, if I do say so myself, we did if you Google Pink Dolphins Taiwan, you'll get a 9-minute video which gives, I think, a pretty good introduction. It's 10 years old now, but or 12 years old, but it's still pretty good. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for all of this, and thank you again for your work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Robin Winkler. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.